Homestyle Green, episode 231, Light in Our Cities and Treading Lightly on Our Environment. G'day and welcome back to another episode of Homestyle Green. This is the podcast dedicated to inspiring people to make a better place to live. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, the host of the show, and this week I've got an interview with Anthony DeMays of DeMays Architects, just out of Melbourne. And Anthony's got a fascination with lighting. He's also really reflective about the role of architecture, and we have a bit of a discussion about whether architects should just aim to do less bad, or if we can actually, and designers and builders can actually have a positive influence on the environment and the environment around us. It's a great chat. Before we get into that, I just want to give a quick shout out to Carbon Light and the team there for supporting the show. If you're building anywhere around Melbourne or the southeast of Australia, get in touch with Burkhart and the team. The amazing thing with that Carbon Light does is produce really high quality buildings in a panelized system. So you can have, for a pretty cost-effective price, very high quality and a very, well, not super speedy, because they do take a lot of care and pay a lot of attention to the quality of the build, but it certainly can be assembled on site at a pretty impressive rate, which is good for the house because it keeps it dry, and it's good for you because it gets your really excellent high-quality home built quickly. Now, let's get on with this week's interview. This is my chat with Anthony DeMays of DeMays Architects, based out of Melbourne, Australia.
Thank you, Anthony, for joining us today. It's great to connect with you. How are things going in your part of the world, in Melbourne?
They're going well. We're in, I guess, the zone where there's been an outbreak or a spike in COVID numbers, so we're not directly affected, but it's kind of around us, and I guess that's leading to a degree of anxiety. So after the early, our early intervention or our early good work, there seems to be some problems, but hopefully we can overcome that. But more broadly, you know, everyone's positive and working well.
I've talked to a few architects recently and wondering whether the situation is going to impact at all how people think about buildings, particularly homes, because we're spending more time in them. I think it's probably a little bit early to tell, but certainly it is forcing people to consider a little bit about internal environment that they're spending time in.
I think there's been a bit of discussion about it. I don't think there's been anything conclusive, as you say, but I think the notion of home, the idea of home, has taken on greater importance. So how that plays out with the design of buildings will be interesting, but certainly there's a lot of discussion about it, whether it's about our own homes, but also homes in terms of people who are vulnerable, domestic violence, social housing, affordable housing. That's all been, you know, kind of debated or discussed in newspapers.
And the impact that architecture can have in that quite diverse range of social impacts, really.
I think we could play a really important role. I think especially as there's a kind of, stimulus packages and things like that, we could actually hopefully do a lot of good as a result of that. So we'll see. I mean, it's still not being played out, but it's certainly being discussed in newspapers and in the press.
What's got you into architecture in the first place, Anthony?
Look, I wish there was a story that said, you know, I always wanted to be an architect. That would be misleading. I mean, the reality is, when I was at high school, I was, generally okay at a lot of the subjects, but not brilliant at any one of them. So I was really searching for what I wanted to do, and it was suggested to me to try architecture for 6 months and then see where I, you know, how that worked, and then maybe transfer to another course. But almost from the day I stepped into the architecture faculty, I sort of found my tribe, shall we say. I can remember the first lecture really clearly, and I just I think the thing that really struck me was that I could see that it would be a something that I could never really get good at in the true sense of the word. It was something that you could keep pursuing. It could be a lifelong pursuit. So that kind of appealed to me, and I just really liked the people that were involved in architecture, and I, you know, from that moment I really enjoyed it, so I've never looked back from there.
Go to the University of Melbourne. Sounds like it was a positive experience.
Particularly the first year lecturer, Hugh O'Neill. I mean, he had a big influence on a whole range of people, but his first lecture, I recall, you know, I was thinking that architecture was Frank Lloyd Wright and, you know, all these sort of notable architects from overseas. Uh-huh. And he brought it back to something local. People like Peter Corrigan, Greg Burgess, who were local identities, and they were doing very much local inspired work, and that sort of really confronted me. You know, it was a real confrontation in terms of what I thought architecture was, and it opened my eyes to what architecture could be. So, yeah, it was very memorable.
What do you think of Frank Lloyd Wright now?
Well, I think he was a great architect. He was just an absolute genius. I mean, he had an ego to match, but he was, you know, incredible. His works, you know, Falling Water, the Guggenheim, the Prairie Houses, they're incredibly beautiful houses. I think he's, you know, he operated in the 20th century, but he was kind of a 19th century architect. I mean, there's the people who have talked about that he was a real arts and crafts architect. He had an affinity for decoration and for a craft model of architecture. So he wasn't really a modernist in the true sense of the word, but absolutely brilliant work.
You say that you don't think you could ever be a good architect in the sense that it's more of a pursuit of the journey. But would you say you're a good architect now?
I think I'm more comfortable being an architect. I think I understand a lot more about what it takes to be a good architect at this point in my career. I've been doing it for 30 years, so I guess if you practice something long enough, you're bound to get good at it. So, yeah, I think definitely feel much more comfortable understanding what it requires to do good work, and then, you know, more confident, I would say, now than ever before in terms of what I think architecture should be and what I can bring to the table. And that's realistically only been in the last, I would say, you know, 5 years that change has occurred.
What brought that change on?
Well, it was really related to changes in the practice. Practice management is a really important part of practice, a part of architecture. You know, it's not just doing good buildings. It's actually how you manage the practice, how you manage clients, how you manage builders, and how you manage, you know, a whole range of things. So I spent a long time getting that right. And I think as a result of that, the architecture, the work that we do is sort of flowed from that. So getting our internal operation, the staffing and all those things working, I think just the flow-on effect was that the architecture actually became much more, much clearer, much easier and more enjoyable.
Your practice is diverse culturally. Was that by design, or was that just sort of the way it's happened and the people that you've attracted?
I think when you run a small practice, I think this would be a universal truth amongst architects, is that you have to work across a reasonably broad spectrum to make practice function, you know, to be viable. Mm-hmm. But to some extent, I've always taken the view that, you know, anyone who comes through the door, anyone who's willing to work with us, we should honour, we should respect, and we should do the best we possibly can. So I've never been an architect that sets a minimum budget, and I've not been the sort of architect that say no to work if, you know, we've got a good relationship with that particular client. So we run a fairly open practice in that sense, and mm-hmm. I have no regrets in doing that because we've met some amazing people along the way.
Yeah. When did sustainability become part of what you do and your brand as an architect?
I went to China in 2007 as part of a trade trip. I mean, I was pretty young and ambitious back then, but the consequence of going to Shanghai at that time was really eye-opening. Basically, the city was clouded in this white mist of pollution. So I was really struck by, you know, how bad it was. The river was really heavily polluted, and I just felt for the kids who were not able to see the nighttime sky. That, I mean, it was just a murky mess, and I just really came back and I did a lot of writing, sort of diary sort of stuff, you know, what's wrong with the world. And I came up with this thing called, you know, which said, you know, design more, consume less, because I couldn't see what role architecture could play in sustainability if, you know, if we're just contributing to the problem and greenwashing the problem. I felt that very uncomfortable about that. So I came up with this idea of design more, consume less, that we design buildings that will ultimately be more energy efficient and contribute to a better outcome. But it doesn't, you know, so I think from that point on, I started to take it much more seriously and became embedded in the DNA of our practice.
Mm. And is that the ethos that you live by today in your practice?
I feel like I've got a new one, which is to do the least amount of damage possible, you know, to do less damage, in the sense that in a funny way, architecture and buildings, we can contribute to sustainabilities, but we have to recognize that buildings do have an impact on the environment. So to some extent, you can't walk away from that. You can't shy away from that. Buildings in themselves consume energy. They require resources. So my philosophy now is to try and do as the least amount of damage that we possibly can. And if that means talking about retrofitting buildings, not building, we will do that. So it's not build at all cost. It's to do the right things by the environment.
I remember one of the books that influenced my thinking was Bill McDowell. With his Cradle to Cradle.
Mm-hmm.
And that has that concept of waste being a human construct, mm-hmm. and the fact that in nature everything relies on something else and it has more than one use. I sort of thought about the same sort of thing, is how could you reimagine the built environment to not just be less bad, but actually be part of nature, or even benefiting nature in some way. And I guess it's hard. It's sort of like an asymptotic curve. You can get closer and closer to that point, but you still have, like you say, an impact on the environment.
I think a good analogy is if you look at something like landscape design or landscape architecture, it's always been interesting to me that when a landscape architect finishes their job, it will be essentially bare earth and plants, let's say, and a pathway. But over time, that pathway, that garden grows and becomes this beautiful place. So after 10, 15 years, you know, people get the benefit of it. Architecture almost works in the reverse. It's sort of in its ideal state when it's finished, you know, when the construction is finished, and then it goes into this kind of steady decline. So, you know, I'm sounding a bit pessimistic here, but you can adopt a kind of view that buildings can be regenerative, or can, through the intervention of people, through being active in the way that we use buildings, buildings can actually be part of the landscape. And that's what I think, that's where I'd like to see architecture go, that we actually contribute, that it actually flourishes over time, so that the point at which you hand a building over to the client, it's actually the start of its journey, and it becomes a flourishing building rather than a building that sort of, you know, ultimately gets demolished at some point in the future.
Mm. What did you change in the way that you worked after coming back from Shanghai?
I think one of the main things is that, you know, if I think about when I started architecture, you know, or started my practice, I was, you know, took on a lot of renovation work, and renovation work is quite tricky. It's, you know, when you're dealing with heritage buildings and the like, you know, and I kind of thought, oh, well, that'll be a stepping stone to bigger and better things, and it's what I have to do to sort of establish my practice. But when I came back from Shanghai, I took the view that, in fact, doing that refurbishment work, the renovation work, was actually a really good sustainable measure, because we were essentially preserving those buildings, or, you know, reinvigorating those buildings to become, you know, new buildings, contributing buildings to the environment. So my view changed very dramatically about my relationship to the work we were doing, which that renovation work is actually good work, and we would continue to advocate for renovation over over rebuilding where possible. Some buildings do need to be demolished because they've reached their end of life, but for the most part, I believe we can do a lot more with the refurbishment of existing buildings.
And the prime example of that would be the low energy house which started life in Collingwood as a warehouse. Is it part of a warehouse, or was this the whole building that was converted?
Just to correct you, it was in West Melbourne. That building had a, you know, really strange life. It's not an uncommon kind of scenario where it was a warehouse in the would have been built in the 1910s, 1920s, a brick warehouse. It then got converted to a unit by someone, you know, in the 80s and 90s. So it had, you know, a pretty cheap sort of fit out, shall we say. It was kind of nice, but it was cheap. And then we came along and we were asked by, you know, some exceptional clients to build a low energy house. So we were using passive house principles. It was the first time I'd, you know, worked with that concept. We didn't get it certified, but we did a lot of work to get the insulation right, to get the windows right, to get the heat exchange right. So that introduced us to that whole concept that we're really interested in.
It's an incredible space. I mean, the image that I'm looking at is the front with the garage, and it looks very industrial. It looks like a warehouse.
It does. It is. It's essentially a warehouse. But it's the image that I suspect you're looking at doesn't really say much. But once you move inside, it becomes, you know, a beautiful, quiet, well lit space. The owner is a lighting designer, and just, you know, the two individuals were just remarkable people. They were really committed to doing a house that would be, a low energy house, so that they wanted to do the right thing. And wasn't that the budget wasn't an issue, but they were committed to doing something that would benefit the environment.
Well, the inside is incredible, and we'll put the link so that people can go and have a look. But it's a very interesting mix of industrial, sort of minimalist, but quite homely as well in a simple way.
The concept for the house comes from a word which is gezellig, which is a Dutch word. Now, it doesn't have a very easy translation into English, but essentially I can only describe it as meaning, you know, good things, good human things. So you can we could be having a cup of coffee, this conversation could be a gezellig conversation, or
right,
go for a bike ride and it could be described as gezellig, or an object could have that kind of attribute. So it was very intentional. The client, you know, used the word gezellig as a springboard for the things that we did in that house. So yes, homeliness is part of that, comfort is part of that, and design is part of that, but it's not a kind of cold minimalist design. It's very much about the human heart and the human mind sort of coming together,
which is hard to do in a warehouse, because it's very hard. It's hard surfaces, concrete, steel, that sort of thing. So to make it comfortable is, while still acknowledging the heritage, I imagine is a bit of a design challenge.
Well, that depends who you come to. I think we do. Yeah. I mean, I genuinely think that's something we do. I really enjoy that transformative effect that we can have on buildings. So I don't see an existing building as being in any way a deterrent or a constraint on what we can possibly do. I sort of see it as a canvas that we can spring off. So I think that's what we're good at. I genuinely do. I think somehow we are able to reimagine existing spaces a bit better than others, maybe.
Clearly. and you've got a huge amount of natural light in there by the looks of it, big sky windows with flooding daylight into an atrium space. Was how did you handle heating overheating? Is there a risk of overheating in a space like that in that Australian environment?
So just on the natural light. In fact, the project came about because of my interest in natural light, and the owner is a lighting designer, and he is also very interested in natural light. And he and I came together because I did a course in Queensland on lighting. I did a master's of lighting, and so did my client. So to explain that issue of the lighting, the atrium space, that's actually outside of the thermal envelope. That is actually kind of, believe it or not, a mud room to some extent.
Right.
So there is actually a really big heavy door from that atrium into the main space. But the main space is actually connected to the atrium in that there are windows from the main living room through that atrium, which connects you to the view to West Melbourne. So it sits outside the envelope. So in a sense, it can heat and cool of its own accord, but the main house is maintained at the right temperature.
Right. That's clever.
Yeah, I think it is, because the other thing about that atrium is that you don't see it on the image that you've probably got in front of you, but there's another laneway from the other end that becomes kind of like a tower, which signals the presence of the house as a home. So that was really, from an external point of view, our main intervention on the property, is that this tower that kind of you see when you walk up to the building that says this is, you know, their address, because otherwise
right.
It's very well concealed, the building. You know, it's very hard to tell people where it is.
So tell me, where's your interest in lighting? Where did that come from?
Well, I guess I was asked, was probably 10, 12 years ago now, to be a judge on a lighting award for the IES. And it was around the time that LEDs were starting to come into the industry, and it may well have already established itself, but I had not really understood just how LED technology was working. So we were seeing a lot of RGB technology, which is, you know, color changing LEDs, and, you know, casinos, the casino here in Melbourne was using a lot of coloured lights, and then there were all these lighting designers that were coming into the frame. And so I was kind of there at the sort of start of that whole shift from old technology to new technology. So I started to think, well, this is really interesting. You know, I can see how this is going to dramatically change the way we think about space and architecture. So I start to become, you know, involved. But then I also, at this coincidentally, did a project in Brunswick where we had some offices that were landlocked, so we had to put in some skylights from above. And look, the way it all worked out, the way the daylight actually infiltrated that space made me think, my God, you know, there's all this lighting technology that's really interesting, but there's this other thing called daylight, which we haven't, you know, which we have never, we've always had, you know, how do we kind of create spaces that are daylit, and how do we create spaces that are lit using artificial light? So that kind of just got me wondering, and I started to pursue it more vigorously by doing a course up in Queensland. I'm not the best student by any means, but, you know, it was a way for me to just kind of get my head around the technology, the science of it, and combine that interest of, you know, electric lighting and daylighting together. So it's funny how it plays out, because it's not like I sit here and sort of design lighting systems, but it's more something that informs the architecture, and something that I pursue through a podcast that I do with a colleague. And there are times where I'm asked on this issue to provide, you know, some commentary or an interview or something like that on. So it's kind of part and parcel of what we do, I suppose.
How much impact does lighting have, and how can it affect people based on your research on their experience of a building?
Well, I suppose it depends. I mean, I guess I'm more interested in it from the, if we're thinking about lighting and the effects on humans. I'm very interested in it in the urban realm. So the fact that we are overlighting our cities and the fact that we're creating these office spaces that are very disconnected to the outside, the fact that we're overshadowing large parts of our CBD areas, the city areas, that so people are not getting contact with the with daylight, so it's affecting our health. So lighting, you know, is a factor in our well-being. It's a major factor in our well-being. We know that shift workers, particularly women, are more likely to be, you know, susceptible to cancer as a result of just, you know, not having that day-night cycle as part of their routine. So it's complicated, but light has an impact on our well-being, and we need to design cities and we need to design spaces with that in mind. So an overabundance of light in our interior environments are not good, and a scarcity of light in our urban environment in terms of daylight is also not a good thing. So, you know, there's a whole range of factors.
And that overabundance, is the quality of that lighting part of the issue as well? Like the fact that it's an overabundance of artificial light, so it's a different spectrum. It's not as broad a spectrum of the whole light that we're designed to have during the day.
The human, we as a species, I mean, electric lighting is essentially 120 years old. But we've evolved over many thousands of years with the idea that you have 12 hours of broad spectrum daylight and then 12 hours, roughly speaking, 12 hours of nighttime, where we had a connection to the stars, to moonlight, where we sought refuge around a campfire, where we rested, where we told stories, those sorts of things. But now, that circadian rhythm, that natural day-night cycle has been disrupted by an overabundance of light, but also technology. You know, we are connected to the screen, you know, to technology, to an iPad, to an iPhone, to smart TVs, all sorts of things. So that's really disrupting our cycle of sleep, so much so that, you know, kids of a fairly young age are using melatonin to help them sleep. They're finding it difficult to wake up in the morning. It's having a huge impact on the way we live. We've evolved, we've changed. I'm not suggesting that we go back to this kind of, you know, agrarian culture of, you know, day and night, but we've got to think about how we adapt to the new technology.
And do you think that architects get enough training on the issue of lighting? And is it considered enough in the requirements of the building code?
I think what's happened is that lighting technology, and this is what I perhaps observed when I was a judge, is that the lighting technology is really quickly changing, and I don't think we can presume that an architect can get across all of the detail, the ability to control lighting, to program lighting, and the sort of technology that exists and the OH&S issues that come out of that. So to some extent, it's gone ahead of where architects' training, you know, typically stops. So that's why we have lighting designers. And then the question of what a lighting designer actually does is their job just to put in more and more lighting, you know, and essentially be, you know, spruiking lights for lighting companies. I mean, that's not what we want. So there's a problem there, I think, that, you know, what is the role of a lighting designer? What's the role of the architect? From a code point of view, it's very complicated, certainly with the way it is written. The amount of lighting that you're allowed to have in a building and the wattages that are allowed in a building, they're good things, but they are also rather inflexible. So we won't see, you know, tremendously creative lighting solutions as a result of the code. And what we need in the built environment, what the human psyche seems to respond to, is variation in light. We like a sort of dynamic sense of what light can bring. So light and shade is a good thing, you know, But in terms of an office environment, it's all about having uniformity and consistency. So much so that people, you know, people go around with a lighting, a light meter and measure the light at a desk. And if it doesn't meet the requirement, then there's a problem. So the eye is this incredible thing. We can read, you know, a newspaper under moonlight, and yet we can go out in broad spectrum daylight and also be very comfortable. So to some extent, the code hasn't really understood the way in which the human eye works, and it's a little bit dull, really, in terms of the way it allows designers to design buildings.
Yeah, because I just thought that a lot of the requirements in the code are for minimum levels of lighting, particularly in work areas, but never really considering a maximum or even the type of light.
They also really emphasise the uniformity of light, particularly in office environments. So you can't get too much variation across, you know, a workspace. Now, that seems like a logical thing to do, but in reality it leads to a fairly boring sort of environment.
Boring and potentially has implications for health and wellness as well. And I think coming back to the low energy house and also some of your other houses, I can see that lighting, you know, you've brought that into your designs, and the difference in lighting it does stand out when you start looking at those images. There are places where it's looks intentionally darker, or it's a different shade. You use different color tones on the walls to create different feels. So it's not just this bland white bright space.
Absolutely. I mean that. Yeah. I mean it's about activating the space. And I think the human mind and the human body enjoys it. So we play a role in it. I think that's why I kind of like residential architecture, because, you know, it's not going to make me rich, I understand that, but it's more that you can be creative and you can sort of engage with issues. And I think we've also done schools, you know, a couple of refurbishment of schools where we applied some of those principles to the work, and I think that was really beneficial. We've done some, you know, it's going back a while, but 2012 we did a canteen, or a brewer's canteen, which was for a craft beer outlet in Port Melbourne, where we used lighting in that. So lighting becomes part of the architecture, part of the fabric of the building for me. It's not something that is there to supplement the space. Try to integrate it and do something. I almost think of lighting as a material in a funny sort of a way, that it has to play its role in the architecture.
Tell me about your involvement with Architects Declare just recently, since last year. How has that come about?
Well, it came about because at the last federal election, I had expected a different outcome, and I was a little bit depressed, I suppose. And I spent about a month moping, thinking, what have we done? You know, I thought there would be some change happening at a federal level, and that didn't happen. So I was a bit down in the dumps, and then so I put a thing on Facebook with a group of architects that I'm involved with, Architeam, who are a great group, and said, is anyone else depressed? I didn't get a big feedback. I didn't get a lot back, to be really honest with you. But
they were all too busy moping as well.
Probably. They were all down the doldrum. But a friend did contact me and said, Stephen Welsh, who said he'd been talking to another colleague, Verity Campbell, who said there was this thing called Architects Declare in the UK, had just came out, which was essentially a declaration of the climate emergency, and they had, I think, 10 or 11, I can't remember now, principles that they asked the 20 RIBA Sterling Award winners to sign up to, and then other signatories could support it. So, you know, before we knew about that, we were kind of thinking we would do something along those lines. And then, you know, Verity asked the people in the UK whether we could adopt their declaration. They said yes. And a group was formed around this idea. We changed, I think, one of the points, which was to be more inclusive of our Indigenous friends. And we put it out there, and it was well received, and, you know, became something that we, well, I and others have continued to work on. My involvement now essentially is to assist with the organisation and the coordination of the group, help run webinars with Stefan Welsh. So we've run, I think, three now, and we're planning the next one in about 2 or 3 weeks. So it's been really interesting. It's been really good.
And are you getting some traction beyond that core group?
Definitely. I think it's after the bushfires here in Australia, which had a dramatic impact, we had a huge upswing of interest in architects there. We had a lot of people putting their hand up to be volunteers. COVID-19 did change that somewhat. I think it's been really interesting, you know, from what we went from, you know, the bushfires through to where we then had floods, then we went to COVID-19. Yeah. So it's been a pretty full-on year. So COVID-19 has sort of overtaken the issue of sustainability and the climate emergency. So, however, we continue to do the work that we do. I think the way it works for us in terms of Architects Declare is that we sort of link things together. In a sense, we're trying to keep it in the public domain. We're trying to keep architects engaged with the issue and educate and promote the issue as best we can. So to that end, I think we're doing a good job and we'll continue to do so, I hope.
Anthony DeMays there of DeMays Architects. He's based in Melbourne. And as Anthony mentioned, check out his other podcast that he co-hosts. It's all about light and the impacts on the urban environment. Some really interesting stuff there about, I hadn't really thought the idea about the fact that we're overlighting ourselves inside our buildings and we're overshading our cities because of all these big buildings in the way and blocking natural daylight. We're spending a lot of time on screens, knew that. Certainly my kids spend a lot of time and I'm constantly trying to get them off screens and outside, get into the natural light. But as designers, it's really fascinating to think about how we can encourage that sort of behaviour to get people back into nature, get more nature into our buildings and give the appropriate amount of light as well. I also really like Anthony's consciousness about the wider impacts of architecture. Again, with the lighting, thinking about the overall impacts of our urban environment, but of course he's also recently helped with the Architects Declare movement, and that's really great recognition of the impact that architects can have globally on one of the biggest issues, or probably the biggest issue facing us all. Check out Anthony's website, that is DeMays Architects. I'll put a link to that in the show notes, and also have a look at his gallery as well. It's got a nice, beautiful little shop front there, which they've made use of and turned it into a nice little art gallery. It's quite a nice little story there. And check out his podcast, and you can find all those show notes at homestylegreen.com/231 for episode 231. Thanks once again to Carbon Light and Burkhardt and the team there in Melbourne as well, in Victoria. Get in touch with Carbon Light if you're considering doing any sort of high-performance home, which everyone should really, if you want a home that's actually fit for purpose, going to be warm, dry, comfortable, and super energy efficient. They also have a great panelized building system there to provide a fully certified passive house if you want to go all the way, which is also highly recommended. So check them out, carbonlight.com.au. Again, you can find the links to them and other great resources on the website. That's enough for me. I'm Matthew Cutler-Welsh, host of the show. Thank you very much for tuning in. Now go make a better place to live. Hey, one more thing just before I go. If you haven't checked it out already, make sure you subscribe and listen to the Passive House podcast. I'm co-hosting the show with Zach Semke from the Passive House Accelerator. So look that up. It's the Passive House podcast. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts.